On behalf of UC San Diego and the region of San Diego, I welcome you to our city. As you heard yesterday briefly from Connect and Cleantech, it's a very dynamic city with respect to energy storage. And as was mentioned yesterday, it was designated the iHub for the state of California in energy storage, which is one of about, I think, nine iHubs that have been identified in various technological areas. And I encourage you all to be here for the mayor's presentation. He's very dynamic with respect to renewable energy. He's probably one of the few mayors in the entire country who can talk about energy storage without reading cue cards. And so there's a reason why this region is the way it is, and it's because of leadership. And the mayor is a big part of that leadership. This morning, we start Section 8, which is Emerging Energy Storage Technologies. And we'll have two rather than three speakers. The second speaker, Martha Schreiber from Cellstrom, on the lifetime of vanadium redox flow batteries, will not be presenting today. So we'll have a little more time for Q&A. We are a little overpopulated on the poster sessions, so we'll have a long, a longer break. Our first paper this morning is from Leiyu Li from Pacific Northwest Laboratories, and it's entitled A New Iron Vanadium Redox Flow Battery System. Leiyu, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for giving us this opportunity here to give you an introduction of our new iron vanadium redox battery. You can see we have a fairly decent size of group. First, I'd like to thank all my co-authors, especially our leader, Dr. Gary Yang, is over there. I think in this room, everyone agree we have we really need energy storage. So we gather here this week. Main purpose is how to find a safe, reliable, efficient, economic way to store this actual electric energy, and also we provide them when we need that. So in terms of medium and large size energy storage, redox flow battery, many people already talk about this technology. It's very promising. This is a schematic illustration of a redox flow battery. And you can see it's basically three parts, analyte tank, catalyte tank, and a stack. This stack is kind of, you can think as a regenerable fuel cell. So you can convert chemical energy into electricity during the discharging. And also, if you have extra electricity, you can convert them back to chemical energy and store them in the solutions. This design, this special configuration of a redox flow battery is extremely suitable for medium or large size energy storage, basically because it has a liquid flow through the stack, so it's actively removed any heat generated inside your stack. So that means you cannot get the catch fire or some overheated in your system. So that's the most important feature of this system. And also because the electricity will start in the two separate tanks that's not connected at all if you do not pumping them through the stack, which means you can store them really long time, so very low cell discharge. And also, you can see the configuration is fairly simple, so it's low maintenance and a relatively long life. And another major feature for this configuration is independent power and the storage capacity design. So if you need more power, you need a larger size of stack. If you need more energy, you can put more solution. So this is just a brief introduction of the redox flow battery. There's a you know, many people working in this area for more than 3 decades. Currently, there's many systems out there, including some hybrid systems like zinc-bromide and zinc-chroming, but also there's two redox battery in the solution systems. One is iron-chrome, and another one is our vanadium sulfate system. Iron-chrome system was invented by NASA in the late 1970s and used iron and chrome. Iron is this one, and the chrome is this one. So it is two electrochemical pairs to provide the energy. And the major advantage of this system is the low cost. The iron and chrome cost is low. A major challenge for this system currently, because it's mostly on the chrome side. As you see, we're using the aqueous solution, so the hydrogen evolution potential is quite close to the chrome, so that indicates you have some hydrogen generation issue, so that relates to your safety. And also, the electrochemical activity of chrome is not very active, so you need an elevated temperature. This temperature need some heat management system to maintain this temperature. If you want to idle for extended period of time, you need to put extra energy back. And also, still related to this chrome side is the it's not very active, so you need some catalyst to make this reaction happen fast. Energy density is around 10 watt-hour per liter, and so another major feature, the one benefit of this system is the iron system here is oxidation power is not very strong, so you can use cheaper hydrocarbon separators, which is the major cost of the stack. In the 1980s, Professor Maria from Australia, she invented another system called our vanadium sulfate system. And this system using vanadium 2 and 3 and vanadium 4 and 5 in a sulfate solution. So use this one single element, so the four different oxygen state, so you can design a very good redox battery. And the energy density, you can get in much, much better, about up to 20 watt-hour per liter, because you have a larger over potential, also slightly higher concentration of vanadium in the system. The major disadvantage of this system is on these vanadium 4 and 5 side. Vanadium 5 is not stable and elevated temperature. If your temperature higher than 40 degrees C, then you have a vanadium pentoxide precipitation in your system, so which indicate you have to have a very good cooling and heat management system in your stack. So you also, and if your environmental temperature is close to this high-end temperature, then you need to put quite a bit of energy into your system to keep it stable. That's largely decrease your energy efficiency. Another disadvantage of this system also related to the vanadium 4 and 5. Vanadium 5 is very strong oxidant, so it's many materials is not very stable in the solution. So for the important part is for the redox flow battery is membrane. The membrane, so right now it's not many choice there. Right now need to use very expensive membrane from manufactured from DuPont. So that's the major cost of the stack. Another thing that some people argue is vanadium cost. Vanadium cost more than the iron chrome cost. But if we consider the chemicals in the redox battery theoretically has unlimited lifetime, so you can reuse them. So this is not a big issue. So as you can see, the major disadvantage of iron vanadium vanadium system that comes from the vanadium 5 and the 4 side, and also the disadvantage of iron chrome come from the chromium side. So we got a very simple idea is we design a new system called a vanadium and iron system. We use iron 2 and 3 on the positive side, and we use vanadium 2 and 3 in the negative side. So this is a new overall reaction, the theoretical voltage about 1.02, which is slightly lower than the iron chrome, which was about 1.2, also lower than the alvinidium system, which was 1.35. But this system, if you use this system, because you get rid of chrome, you get rid of the 1.4 and 1.5, you have many potential advantages. So the major advantage is you have a much wider operation temperature window. So this one, we expect you can run pretty much all the environmental temperature in the most area in the world. So you do not need a heat management system. You do not need to sacrifice your energy efficiency. So that not only for the efficiency, also kind of like the capital cost and also safety-related issue, you can get rid of that. And also you don't have the hydrogen gas evolution, don't need a catalyst, and you don't have the precipitation issue with the vanadium pentoxide. Another benefit of this one is as the same as the iron chrome system, we can use a low-cost hydrocarbon membrane, which can largely reduce the cost of the stack. Yeah, that's what we think. And this is the first set of data we collected with the iron vanadium system. And this is a CV curve. You can see the vanadium 203 pair and the iron 203 pair. So that indicates you can design a cell with these two pairs. And this is the cell voltage profile this is charge and this is discharge. Generally, it's possible you can get a cell that's with a decent performance with this iron vanadium system. And we use, this is the performance of 1.25 iron vanadium hydrochloride solution. We use a mixed iron and the vanadium in both sides, so it will prevent the crossover effect. And this one, we still use nanofilm membrane. You can see the energy efficiency, the right one is about 80%. And also you can see this is the second number. Well, this is generally that this is capacity is relatively stable. It's about 0.1% decrease per cycle. The vanadium sulfate system, you have about 0.3% decrease per cycle. And you have the energy density is about like discharge, this is charge. So if you talk about discharge, it's a little bit over 10 watt-hour per liter. As we expect, we should have a much wider operation temperature window. So we use an extreme condition, the SOC state of charge 0 to 100. So we test the solution offline from 0 degrees C to 50 degrees C. And we find it's very stable for an extended period of time. And this is the cell performance and the different temperature. At higher temperature, we can have the slightly better energy efficiency. At a low temperature, the efficiency dropped about 10% to around 70%. And also, you can see the cycle performance. At high temperature, you have the capacity decrease a little bit faster. Low temperature is slightly decrease. So that was what we call the first generation iron vanadium system. But that one, you see the performance is not quite good. So we continue to improve that system. We had a concept called the mixed acid concept. We successfully used that in the all vanadium system. We largely improved the energy density, about double the vanadium energy density, and also we largely expanded operation temperature window. So we in this system, we also use the same concept. We're using a mixed acid concept as a supporting solution. So we see if we can get a better performance. First thing we can see is we can improve the active material concentration in the solution more than 20%. And also we find that the stability from 0 degrees C to 50 degrees C, the solution is very stable. It's 100% sterile charge and discharge. And this is the CV curve, and this CV curve shows you can design a good cell, a better cell than previous one, with this new supporting electrolyte solution. And that's the one on the other side is the cell performance. Cell performance that's improved using this new system, especially if you compare that to the second cycle and the 100th cycle, you almost see no change. That indicated that the cell is very stable. And this is the efficiency, the energy efficiency here. If you're using Nefion membrane, we can get the 83%. It's DC to DC energy efficiency. And also the energy density here, we can get about 15 watt hour per liter. So it's close to the vanadium sulfate system. So this is better than the iron sulfate. So this is a different temperature data. We test this from 0 degrees C to 50 degrees C. It gives a similar performance, 80% more efficient. And also we test that energy density on the other side, so we can see it's at ambient and slightly higher, we have around 15 with 1 hour per liter. This one shows that using a hydrocarbon separator, which is only less than 1% of the cost of Nefion membrane. So this data shows if you're using the hydrocarbon separator, you can still get 70% energy efficiency and more than 13 1 hour per liter energy density. And we have not observed any capacity decay so far. We run more than 50 cycles. We're still running this. This slide is just a kind of a summary. We compared our new iron vanadium system with the conventional vanadium sulfate system and the conventional iron chrome system. And then the major advantages of this new system, we can say, is we do not need a temperature control, and we this is reliable and very low maintenance. The energy density is similar as the vanadium sulfate, and higher than the iron chrome, and we also can use a much lower cost separator for this system. And we, in the future, we'd like to demo this new system, 1 kilowatt scale prototype, and we are actively working with investors and industry partners to commercialize this unit. We can get 2 or 3 years, we can have a 1 megawatt hour system demonstrated. And at last, I'd like to thank our financial support from DOE OE, especially Dr. Emma Gilk. And also I'd like to thank our internal funding and thank DOE EMSO facility for some analysis support. And thank you for your attention.
For those of you who joined us after the session started, the paper from Martha Schreiber, The Lifetime of Redox Flow Batteries, will not be presented this morning. And so we're going to go straight to Dr. Craig Horn's presentation, which is the from Intervault Corporation here in California. And that is looking at breakthroughs in redox flow battery technologies. And we'll hold questions to the end, and we'll have ample times in which to entertain questions. Thank you. Craig?
Thank you, Byron. I want to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. Today I'm talking to you about the storage demo project we have going on at Intervault Corporation in partnership with Raytheon K-Tech of Albuquerque, New Mexico. I appreciate the cooperation and support from Raytheon K-Tech. And Intervault is based in the San Francisco Bay Area down near San Jose, California. Let's see. How's this? Great. I'd like to acknowledge the support of the U.S. Department of Energy under the RO Storage Demo Project Program Section 2.5. Our program managers, Imre Juk and Kim Newfer. Also, we've had some matching funds from the California Energy Commission, and our program manager there, Avtar Binning, is here in the audience. Thank him. And we've also, some of the work I'll show today is based on a New York State grant from NYSERDA, and Jennifer Harvey's our program manager there, and we thank them for their support as well. So the objectives of this project is to demonstrate an advanced redox flow battery technology and put that live on the grid in California as part of the demonstration for the renewable-based smart grid that's coming forward. We're going to be integrating this advanced energy storage system with an existing PV array that's located at an almond farm out near Turlock, California, so that's about 2 hours east of our location in Central California. It's a very rich agricultural region. Over 75% of the world's almonds come from about a 200-square-mile area right in there. So agriculture is very important. It's a $2 billion export industry to California, and it's also very water-intensive. Almond trees, they're very valuable, and one thing about them, it takes about 5 years for a tree to start producing nuts. So if you lose a string of trees because you haven't got water there, and some of the days during the summer for periods of time will exceed over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, you lose a string of trees, the farmer has lost a significant amount of capital going forward. So they're very concerned about energy surety and be able to get water to the trees there. And so this project is a way to help them increase their energy surety and also maintain economic viability and strength here in California. And with the technology, what we'll do is not only help farmers have increased energy surety, but also help them reduce their irrigation costs. It's a very large, when you look at that industry as a whole, the agricultural industry for on-farm groundwater pumping, you're talking about peak loads that could exceed 900 megawatts in the middle of the summer. So it's a pretty significant energy user. So in addition to Raytheon K-Tech, I mentioned the DOE, California Energy Commission, NYSERDA, JKB Energy is a partner out there that put out this that put this field array in, and it's been operating since December 2008. Okay. So the project phases, currently we're coming to a close on phase one. We'll be closing that in January 2012 with the receipt of our large-scale test unit. At that point, we'll have the complete building block for the big system under test and proven out. In phase two, then, we'll be designing a 250 kilowatt, 1 megawatt hour redox flow battery, building that out in Albuquerque at Raytheon K-Tech with the Cascades being built by Enervolt, bringing that out there, having all the controls and everything done. And then the final phase will be commission and operation out at the almond farm the second half of next year. So we look at the project team breakdown. At Enervolt, we're concentrating on the overall product architecture, and we're developing the technology through three different phases, lab scale, prototype scale and product scale. And each one of those is roughly a 10x increase in scale throughout, and I'll talk about the progress on that here coming up. Of course, the core electrochemistry and the system modeling and also the cascade design and the preliminary system design. Raytheon K-Tech is an expert in controls and energy systems, so they'll be doing the overall then final system design and developing that system and integrating the whole package and the fabrication and delivery out to Turlock. Let me grab my... Excuse me. All right, thanks. So for project metrics and benefits, we installed a meter at the site last April, so we'll have over a year of baseline data to look at the energy consumption of the groundwater pump that's out there at that site. We've been looking at the energy consumed and therefore the daily cost based on the Pacific Gas and Electric tariffs that are in effect for that site, and we'll be able to look at the impact of energy usage and savings and other economic and environmental metrics for that site going forward. So let me talk about why flow batteries are important and why the support from the DOE, NYSERDA, and CEC is so valuable to the industry. One great attribute about redox flow batteries is you have complete decoupling of power and energy. To me, that was one of the things that got me attracted to this technology space. And the advantages is it makes it very straightforward to design systems with different levels of power and energy, all from the same building blocks. So you see here on the chart in the upper left and in the lower left part of that system, what I draw an analogy to is a fountain drink with the two cups and straws in it, where the straws determine your power delivery, how fast you're drinking, and the cups can then determine how long you drink. And so if you need to go to higher power, you just need to basically have more straw area. If you need to drink longer or longer duration, longer energy, you just need bigger cups. So you can size the system accordingly to different markets, basically by having one or two different part numbers. The other thing is they're cost effective for very long duration, because all you're doing to go, say, from a 4-hour system to a 6-hour system is adding 50% more electrolyte, a 50% larger tank. Tanks actually get less expensive as they get larger. You get great economies of scale, especially as you go out to longer and longer durations. And essentially, as you start getting into the 10 to 20 hour range, you can approach the cost basis of pumped hydro. Systems can be very long life because these are very simple, elegant electrochemical reactions. You're just taking an electron from one ion in solution and bring it over to the other ion in solution. So very reversible, very long life. And the electrolytes themselves, as Liu said, never wear out. So you have a very high residual value, especially in high energy systems. That can really help lower the levelized cost of electricity. The other thing in manufacturability, and this is another great attribute, is you're unitizing power within the stacks themselves, and there's large surface areas of contacts between cells, and then also unitizing energy within the tanks themselves. So to go to larger capacities, you just need to mix more solutions. This really helps simplify the transition from development into manufacturing and lowers the cost of commercialization. The other thing, there's brand new manufacturing methodologies that come about with stack manufacturing and system manufacturing, and this is a key way for the U.S. to establish leadership in this. And it's really a new technology. NASA invented redox flow batteries in the mid-70s, but today most of the deployment has been in China. And the RF storage demo project such as this really helps us maintain U.S. leadership in this space. So let me talk about Enervault's innovation and the reason we're moving forward here and gotten the investment and awards that we have. We have a technology called the Engineer Cascade, and what this does is really transforms the design of the stack, which is the heart of the redox flow battery system. And what we do, rather than have a set of stacks that are in a system connected hydraulically in parallel, they're hydraulically in series. So we move electrolyte through the stack set as a series of stages. And what this does is it transforms the operation of a flow battery from a system where it's constantly changing over time as the reactants become more dilute, as they continuously pump through, to one where it's steady state operation. And of course, a steady state process is much easier to control and harness than a process that's continually dynamic. And with this transformation, we can use very low-cost materials, not only the reactants themselves. So our first implementation is with the iron chromium system, very low cost of reactants, but we can also use very inexpensive components in the cell. Rather than needing ion exchange membranes, whether they're perfluorinated or not, they're still pretty expensive. We can use micropore separators from the lithium ion and lead acid industries. Those are available today. They're very high reliability materials in the solutions that our reactants are dissolved in. And they're widely available, so we don't have a problem with supply. They're about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude lower cost than ion exchange separators. And so this fundamentally transforms the economics of the stack and the overall system. So therefore, we can get the safety of a redox flow battery design, that decoupling of power and energy, and the fact that the reactants are dissolved in water, so you have a high thermal mass, so you don't have to worry about thermal runaway, the reliability of a steady-state process, and a very high degree of cost effectiveness. We won several awards over the last couple of years for our technology, from Top Utility Solution, Utility Tech Challenge, to a couple awards from Going Green. And we're a finalist in the Energy Storage Challenge that takes place this coming Monday. Also, we've received the U.S. Patent Award on this design, the Engineer Cascade, and it's not specific to the iron chromium system. So really, we consider ourselves a chemistry-agnostic company. We developed rapid development capabilities in order to make this happen and the system commercialization proven out. We go from lab cells that are about 20 square centimeters to 200 square centimeters at the prototype scale, and we have systems that allow us to look at material interactions and base efficiencies up to a fully integrated system that you see here, PTS Bravo on the lower left. That's a fully integrated package system. And then we can take that, the different technology developments, then up to product scale. So this is the Bravo system. It's very safe. Feel comfortable having my daughter stand in front of it while it's operating. It's functional at 2 to 7 kilowatts and 10 to 20 kilowatt hour capability, but it's fully packaged with a control system and everything else, and it's been a great tool for us to do the development. So some of the development highlights in the core electrochemistry, the electrochemical team has done a great job looking at, as Lee, you said, the side reaction with the chromium electrode. You have to worry about hydrogen generation. They've been able to diminish that to a level that's 20 times lower than what NASA was able to do. This means we can get very stable cycling. As you see here, well over 120 cycles with stable operation. On the cascade development, you could see both charge and discharge profiles, voltages from the different cells in there, very uniform voltage profiles within the for the cells within a stage and from stage to stage. And then in terms of performance, switchover time is one of the things we've been testing out for the NYSERDA award. You can see on the right there, very rapid switchover, less than 1.5 seconds to go from charge to discharge. And really that test we found was limited by the contact resistors within the system itself rather than the flow battery operation. So as you look here on the lower right for how the system's working, the cascade technology then allows us one positive attractive attribute of it is that the battery operates at steady voltage, both in charge and discharge. So on the bottom left, you see the current trace and then the corresponding in red, the voltage response of the system, both at So at discharge and charge, charge up there and discharge down there. So you can see that steady state voltage, that dramatically lowers the cost of inverting DC into AC brings about a more reliable and higher efficiency inverter. See here, startup unconditioned DC power trace from the system. Within a couple cycles, it stabilized, and this was an early test, so we've been able to improve that now, and nice power response of the system as well. We scaled up now that we're at product scale, so this is a system test bed that we have. We've done some CFD analysis on it, and you can see here how we've improved with the engineering teams, improved the flow field uniformity by several fold. And late last month, we got our 7-kilowatt test beds online, and those systems are running now with product scale stacks in there. So for the milestones, we've demonstrated the full stack design itself. The next milestone is the 21-kilowatt building block for our systems. We've had a couple delays in resource availability and then some long lead time items coming in. So that system is actually due in at the end of December. So that test will be done in January right now. In next summer, we'll get the system out there on the field. Once we get the alpha cascades tested, then we'll start replicating those, and those will be the building block for the 250-kilowatt system. And then the last half of next year will be in the demonstration phase with the technology. Want to just acknowledge how the interaction between the different funding sources have come about as we look at product development and test system development. So the NYSERDA award gave us a first fully packaged integrated system at the prototype scale, complemented the breadboard system that we made in-house. And then with the California Energy Commission, that's supporting the work here on the system, the product scale building block. And then the ARRA demonstration award has been provided full support throughout the whole project stream, and so we're grateful for that. The impact, just quickly to wrap up, then the impact of this technology energy storage in general, we'll see lower cost of sure and reliable electricity, You know, there's a blackout here last month that caused a lot of pain for a lot of people. That's something, if energy storage systems were out there, likely could have avoided that that event. So improved grid stability and optimizing the existing transmission and distribution network. Of course, with energy storage systems in place within the distribution network, you can avoid the use of peakers. You can shut down peakers that are inside city centers, like some of the once-through cooling plants that are up in the L.A. Basin, so you can provide cleaner air and a healthier environment for your citizens. You can enable predictable electricity prices, because once you put in an energy storage unit with renewable resources like wind and solar, you know what your costs are going to be today and 10 years from now, so you don't have to worry about price shocks. And this is something, especially when you look at a market space like agriculture with farmers, one of the things they hate is uncertainty in energy prices. And here in California, twice in one decade, they saw price shocks that no one had predicted, first in 2001 with the California energy crisis, and then in 2008 with the run-up of commodity prices. So in summary, the design's been validated. We're moving forward with the project. We'll have the system building block in phase one done in January. We're moving forward. We're tracking our actual costs and baselines moving forward. And this will be an important technology to have happen, and we're grateful for the support. Thank you. Okay.
Phones floating around, and if you would once again please identify yourself and pose your question. Questions? In the front, please.
Good morning. I'm Eva Gerdo from First Energy, and Craig, you spoke on one of your slides about a simplified PCS. I was wondering if you could just provide an explanation for that, what that means.
So with the characteristic of having a constant operating voltage on charge and discharge, therefore you don't need the front-end boost circuitry on an inverter to boost the DC signal up to a level before it's transformed into AC. So we've been working with some different inverter manufacturers out there, and you could realize a cost savings of anywhere from 25 to 50% on the cost of an inverter by eliminating that circuitry. It's also that section of the inverter is comprised of capacitors that are actually the lower reliability component within the inverter architecture. So that's how that increases the reliability of the inverter unit. And it also is a pretty significant efficiency loss within that. So you'll avoid that too.
Another question? Yes, sir, right here. If you wait for the microphone, she's one step away. Thank you.
Al Caesar, Lindheck. Craig, you say you're using just a microporous separator between the iron and chromium sides. Mm-hmm. Do you have any problem with cross diffusion of the iron and chromium?
No, because I didn't get a chance to really get into the nitty-gritty, but the way that the system operates is we actually have iron and chrome in both electrolytes, and that's an innovation that NASA had developed towards the end of the program, called the mixed electrolyte system. So we have the discharge product of iron in the chromium electrolyte and the discharge product of chrome in the iron electrolyte, and that gives you an elementally identical solution. But also, more importantly, it also gives you an ionically identical solution at the bottom of the cycle, or at fully discharged state. And so the electrolytes actually become one in the fully discharged state, and that's a big advantage of this system over a vanadium system.
Another question? I have one for Dr. Lee. While you're pondering your next question to the panel, you mentioned that your system does not have an active heat management system. Would you expound a little bit about the significance of that capability with respect to operating cost as well as safety?
Yeah, I think that working, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's something we've been working so hard in the past 2 years, try to get rid of the temperature control of redox battery system. You know, if you, you know, you know, the flexibility is a very big requirement when you're using this energy storage system. So you can use that within 2 hours, or you can use that within like 10 hours or maybe 20 hours. So if you need to control the temperature or control the things, not only largely increase your capital cost, also the energy cost. So we are still in a very early stage, so we have not calculated all those equipment cost. But in terms of efficiency, you know, say for the current vanadium sulfate system, if the environmental temperature is 40 degrees C, so the round trip energy efficiency is 80%, that means when you run this at a temperature above 40 degrees C, you have to sacrifice extra 20% energy efficiency using cooling system, assuming you can have 100% efficiency of your cooling energy system.
Right. Okay, thank you. Question on the right, my right.
Yes, Bob Savino, Case Western Reserve. One of the advantages of flow batteries, you can usually go through a large state of discharge or state of charge, like 5% to 95% or 10% to 90%. But when we see data often given, you show cycles and capacity and efficiency, but it's not usually mentioned what the state of charge range is in these tests. Is there a standard that people now test against in terms of a range of state of charge?
Is it for me or for you?
maybe you can give a academic type answer. I can give a more commercial.
Okay. That's a very good question. You know, in terms of it's many things to decide that. You know, if you calculate the potential, that's largely depend on the concentration of the active material in the system. Normally, we run not 100% cell charge or cell discharge. Normally, we run only 20%, 80% efficient, the range, so you have about like 60% utilization. But that's not always true, because it depends on the concentration of your active material. Eventually, if you concentration too low, if your starting material concentration too low, and then you have a hard time, you know, for the mass transfer, so you cannot get that ratio, that range. If you have a higher concentration, you can get that range, or even lower, then you have a better utilization.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. I think that is something that needs to be understood if you're looking at when you're looking at data and making comparisons, more on a system-to-system, on what I'd say is on a research scale. For a commercial scale, the way that we look and are testing our system is for the commercial implementation. And when we rate a system at a megawatt hour, that is the available capacity. So the theoretical capacity would be higher, but the cost on a dollar per kilowatt hour and the megawatt hour system itself and those specifications would be on ability to deliver a megawatt hour at that power rating of the system itself. So in some ways, it's immaterial as we look at it, because the customer doesn't really see it from that side. But it's something that one of the avenues of continuous improvement we're constantly pushing on, as would any flow battery manufacturer.
A question on the left, yes.
It's not mm-hmm. a question, really. It's a commercial. So if I can just sort of come in here.
Oh, by all means. Let's hear your commercial.
This matter of comparing performance of different flow batteries was addressed over the last two International Flow Battery Forum meetings. And as a result, there is a workshop agreement being planned to cover these standardization and characterization topics. So if anyone is interested in how to characterize a flow battery, either come and see me or look at the IFBF website. And our first meeting to discuss this is the day before the IRS conference in Berlin this coming November. So it's a very important, relevant topic. And there is an opportunity now for anyone with an interest in flow batteries to get involved in that. Thank you.
And you believe about when that will that workshop be held?
Well, the workshop process will start on the 27th of November. A workshop agreement takes a minimum of about 9 months. Ideally, will be completed within a year. So this is an order of magnitude faster than getting an international standard. So it's really quite an important topic, and it's a one-off opportunity for people to get involved in trying to determine what characteristics need to go forward in characterizing flow batteries.
Okay.
And the workshop agreement is an ideal way of advancing knowledge in a fast-moving area.
Thank you very much. And let me punctuate that point. Here in California, many of you might be aware that we just had a reauthorization of the self-generation incentive program, which maintained the incentive level for a capital buy-down subsidy of $2,000 a kilowatt for the first 1 megawatt, and then $1,000 a kilowatt for the second megawatt, and $500 a kilowatt for the third megawatt. But what's important that speaks to the point is now there will be performance measuring where the grant is not paid 100% up front. It's paid 50% up front. And following that, the balance is paid out over the next 5 years based upon performance. And if you don't have the metrics as to how you're performing, how can you get paid? So it's a very vital process, not only in flow batteries, but in all batteries when it comes to getting paid for incentives. Any other additional questions? Yes.
Do you have any specific cost target based on what you know today, what your plans are?
We participated in the EPRI study last year that AECOM performed in conjunction with EPRI, and that resulted in the EPRI white paper that was released last December. So if you look in there, you'll see an entry for iron chromium, and that's our input, and that shows our cost would be on the order of $300 to $400 a kilowatt hour, depending on how, you know, they put some risk factors in there. And that was, they took input from different manufacturers, many different types of energy storage systems, and that was one of, if not the lowest cost in the different categories that that we were rated in.
Okay. And we have time for one last question in the front. Thank you.
Tony Vasala from University of Sydney for Craig. There was some loss of capacity in, you know, the first 100 cycles that you were showing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you shed some light as to where you think that loss is coming from? Is it electrolyte or electrodes?
Yeah, that loss, that was a system that didn't have active rebalancing, so it was balance loss in that system to begin with. So,
can you shed some light on your electrode material?
It's carbon-based. Yeah,
that's one of the secrets. That tune and two vowels.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's one thing. There's no, there's no expensive heavy metals or precious metals in the system as well, which is one of the reasons why the cost numbers came in where they have. So.
Okay, with that, I would like to thank our two panelists and give them a round of applause. For the poster presenters to come up to the podium here, and we'll have a short presentation by them. I do have a couple important announcements of what's coming up, and I just saw Avtar enter the room. Do we have any announcement as of today? Not yet, but just to whet your appetite, the California Energy Commission this past 7 months has funded a project called Energy Storage Vision 2020 for California that was authored by individuals at UC Berkeley, UCLA, and at UC San Diego, where I reside. And it's been a process that has been vetted very strongly with the California Energy Storage Alliance, as well as other members of the private and public sector, and it is days away from being posted on a website, and we hope to have that information out to all of you very shortly. But it's a very comprehensive study, and I encourage you all to read it, and hopefully it will be a foundation for the process that has already commenced in California with what we call AB 2514, which is the legislative act that is looking towards developing and accelerating the utilization of energy storage on both sides of the meter. So that's hopefully days away from being released. All right, our next session, we'll have three speakers, and I think, do you want to, your paper is the, the compressed air energy storage. Why don't we start with you with respect to, again, the poster sessions are on the, are going to be presented out front. We're going to give each presenter 3 minutes in which to introduce the topic and then invite you to engage in more formal one-on-one conversations as we continue into the break. Okay, thank you.
Great. Good morning. My name is Aparna Narang, and joining me today in the front row as well is Bob Booth, and we're here to provide an overview of the compressed air energy storage project that Pacific Gas and Electric is currently working on. The overall objective of PG&E's project is to demonstrate the viability of advanced underground CAES technology and develop best practices to accelerate the technology's market readiness in the U.S. The discrete project objectives are to verify the technical performance of advanced CAES technology using a porous rock reservoir as the underground storage reservoir medium. At this time, only two CAES facilities exist in the world, one in Alabama and one in Germany, and both use salt domes as their air store. We'll also be looking to integrate intermittent renewable resources by using the CAES plant to provide services to study the power fluctuations from load and intermittent renewables. We'll also look to maintain emergency spinning, non-spinning reserve, and perform VAR support. The proposed project is targeted to evaluate the feasibility for a CAES facility up to 300 megawatts with up to 10 hours of storage in a porous rock reservoir. The project is broken into three phases. We're currently in phase one, which is the reservoir testing and plant design phase. The phase one is currently funded by the Department of Energy, Pacific Gas and Electric customers, and the California Energy Commission. Slide three goes into greater detail regarding the project phases. As mentioned previously, phase one includes the site selection process, verification of the reservoir, engineering for the facility, environmental studies, and permit preparation work for the full facility. Finally, we will have a request for offers for parties to construct and own a CAES facility. The results of the phase one work will accumulate in a final report to the Department of Energy. And based on the phase one results, the technical and economic viability for CAES will be assessed and evaluated by PG&E management to determine if we would proceed into phase two and three of the program, which would include the full construction of a CAES facility in California. The CAES project team is currently active on step one of the reservoir testing plan, which is essentially completing the desktop studies and identification of sites. Our poster presentation helps provide greater depth of information regarding our progress to date and lessons learned during our desktop analysis. Another important aspect of the CAES project is evaluating the economic viability. As you can see on this slide, we're looking at revenue drivers, variable cost drivers, and fixed cost drivers. And lastly, an important aspect of the CAES program is to look at the equipment that we're proposing to evaluate, which is the next gen of Alabama technology and the second generation technology. Seeing that my time is up, thank you very much for your time, and I would like to thank the Department of Energy, the California Public Utilities Commission, and the California Energy Commission for their support to help make this happen. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next presenter will be Nellie Tong from KEMA, and she will be substituting for the presentation the characteristics and assessments of novel bulk storage technologies. Nellie?
Hi, I'm Nelly Tong, and I'm going to talk about my posters today about novel bulk energy storage technologies. This project is sponsored by Department of Energy, and KEMA worked collaboratively with Centec SRA International to work on this project under the direction of Sandia Lab. So the purpose of this project is really to look at novel bulk energy storage concepts that are existing and what the statuses are, what kind of barriers that they're facing, and what kind of government support they would need in order to bring it closer to commercialization. So first we identify six applications that are applicable and suitable for bulk energy storage technologies. And I'm not going to go into details because we've talked a lot about these applications already. But basically, we're looking for a long discharge duration, deep discharge depth, and a fast response time, and a minimum cycle of at least a few thousand cycles. So we looked at 17 technologies, and these technologies, we have a strong focus on pumped storage hydro, as well as compressed air energy storage. And for each of these technologies, we looked at their efficiency, we looked at the energy, the power levels, the cost, both fixed and variable cost, as well as the strength and weaknesses, the siting and permitting requirements, and you know, all of that, also including we looked at what companies are doing research on these technologies, as well as projects that are already installed or not installed. So after we characterized these technologies, we evaluated them both technically and economically, and through a Delphi process. And this process, we have a list of panelists who reiterated an evaluation. And so this is the result of the evaluation for these different technologies. So after we evaluated these technologies with the criteria that I've mentioned in a previous slide, we decided that ocean and variable speed technologies for pumped storage hydro has a short time frame of commercialization. And for CAES, it's near isothermal technologies with a short time frame of commercialization. So here you can see we divided up all the technologies by short term, medium term, and long term. And for each of these different technologies, we have suggested different types of government support that's needed. So, for example, the short term technologies, we recommended demonstration support and incentives for commercialization. So I'm about out of time, but we also look at technology readiness levels and barriers as well. I have a lot more pretty pictures for you if you come see me at the poster or around the KEMA booth. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nelly, and a great tease to invite them out to your posters with the pretty pictures. Our next speaker to introduce their poster session is Dr. Samir Sukar from the National Resource Defense Council, and he'll be speaking on compressed air storage and geographic aggregation that's mutually reinforcing strategies for integrating wind power, a very important subject. Samir, thank you.
Great, thank you very much. So I don't have a lot of time, but I just want to give you a little bit of the flavor of the work that we've been doing, this ongoing research, looking at the economics of large wind systems coupled to compressed air energy storage with my collaborator, Bob Williams at Princeton. This is an outgrowth of work that I did at Princeton. Essentially, the focus here is looking at the impact on the system economics from what I'm calling geographic aggregation, which is shorthand for leveraging the geographic diversity through resource aggregation on a large geographic scale. So essentially, and I don't have time to go through too much of the details here, but we have cost optimization for a system that has wind and Ks, remote from load, connected through long-distance transmission with local gas generation. And so you can provide backup either from Ks or natural gas-fired generation, and then we're going to optimize the system to give lowest levelized cost of energy with subject to constraints related to the capacity factor and capacity value of the system to make it a kind of a base load equivalent system. These are the well-known curves that show power duration for a wind turbine array with a somewhat idealized power curve for the wind. So essentially, this is it's hard to read a little bit, but this is N equals 1. For one wind turbine array, N is equal to 4 for 4, and N equal to 16. And so, you know, the well-known trend is that essentially as you start to aggregate more and more of these wind turbines, the time in which they're all producing rated power is reduced, the amount of time which they're all experiencing lulls is also reduced, so that means that the maximum power, the area under the right left-hand side is reduced, the area under the right-hand side is increased, and that essentially smooths out, basically a long way of saying that you smooth out the output. The interesting thing we found is that if you look at real wind data, here we took data from the EWITS database off of NREL's website, compared to the synthetic time series, the resource, the geographic diversity saturates rather quickly, even if you're looking, even in this case where you're looking at 16 sites over a pretty broad region of MISO and SPP. So, you know, that's to say that the benefits do exist, but they do saturate. So I don't want to go too far into this. The important part is the green, which is the output from the K's plant in a power duration curve. And as you go from N equals 1 to 16, that the size of the green is reduced, which means that the capital cost of the K's system is reduced as you take into account the impacts of aggregation on the output of the system. And so if you have a system here, we have levelized cost of energy for a natural gas system, wind backed by natural gas, and then wind backed by K's. The wind K system comes in at a very high fuel or carbon price, but then if you go to aggregation N equals 16, that intermediate regime where wind backed by gas is reduced, K's becomes more competitive, and bottom line is that energy storage and resource aggregation can be mutually reinforcing strategies for integrating wind power. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, at this point, I could say we're going from case to case, but our next speaker is Professor Bob Savinel from Case Western University, who will be talking about the simulation and optimization of a flow battery in area regulation markets. Thank you.
Thank you. We started work in the flow battery area, working on more fundamental issues. And recently we just started an all-iron flow battery, which you'll see at the peer review tomorrow if you want to visit our poster. It's a new program sponsored by the Office of Electricity in Sandia. But this work today I'm going to talk about is from a graduate student, a one-year master's degree student, did this project on this. And we want to look at a specific regulation, because there are lots of different targets for specific regulation or for different type of batteries for storage. And we wanted to pick one specific regulation. So we asked a couple questions, you know. If we put in an energy storage system into an application, What is the economic cost target of an energy storage system for this particular application based on, let's say, a net present value type financial analysis? How often is the battery available to accept charge and to deliver charge without overcharging? And what is the optimum energy to power ratio? Because we know vanadium flow batteries, they have one of the significant advantages, you get very large energy to power ratios, whereas many conventional batteries you can't. So what is the optimum energy to power ratio? So we want to ask those three questions, and we want to sort of create a simulation and do that. And so we picked a system. We picked a 2-megawatt system capacity. We were imagining this is in California because you're talking about up to about 400 megawatts of ancillary capacity for area regulation. So we're looking at 30 minutes uptime or downtime regulation. And what we're basically doing is we're looking at price data that was listed in 2008 in the California ISO. So we can get actual data of upregulation, downregulation. And what we did is we included that into a model and made an assumption about this 2-megawatt system being able to accept power at any given time or accept energy or delivering energy and competing against the idea of buying and selling ancillary type costs and looking at how that works out. And our conclusions are very simple. We come up with an energy storage solution below $500 per kilowatt hour installed could work in this particular application with these set of assumptions. The optimal energy to power ratio is surprisingly small for this type of application. It's about 1.4. But the study does result that you need a large number of cycles, indicating the importance of stability and durability of your system. And, of course, efficiency loss has a large impact on the energy and revenue loss of the system. So if you have time, I encourage you to come by my poster. I'm glad to talk to you more about it. And we just had a paper that was just published on this within the last week in the Journal of Applied Electrochemistry, so there's much more details on it in there, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great.